This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
The Drew Mariani Show. On Relevant Radio.
Welcome back and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. And if you're anything like me, you probably are very interested in the legal machinations, if you will, of all sorts of different public policy issues. Or, for instance, there were a couple of very interesting rulings in the Supreme Court today regarding one was regarding immigration, and another was regarding the military draft. And in both cases, the Supreme Court more or less decided that they were going to defer to Congress on those issues, which is sort of an interesting form of judicial restraint, rather than trying to insert themselves into statutory issues that Congress had already addressed and was going to address again. Last week, however, a federal judge in California overturned a 32-year-old law that banned the sale and use, the sale and ownership of AR-15s. And this was a very interesting decision. It's going to clearly be challenged to the Ninth Circuit. Here to discuss that with us is Dave Koppel. He's a research director of the Independence Institute in Denver and an associate policy analyst with the Cato Institute in Washington. Great outfit there, cato.org. He's also an adjunct professor of constitutional law at Denver's University Sturm College of Law. He's the author of The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, the Judeo-Christian Tradition. You can find him online at davekoppel.org and on Twitter at Dave Koppel, D-A-V-E-K-O-P-E-L. Dave, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting ruling in a number of different ways, right? It's an entertaining ruling in a number of different ways. But tell us a little bit about the case itself and how this ended up being, how this, you know, 30-something-year-old law ended up being overturned.
Well, the issue of bans on so-called assault weapons, which is a very misleading name, has been litigated for decades. But
right,
this is the first case of its kind that actually went to a full trial. Most of these cases have been decided at earlier pretrial stages, like the a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment. But this case had the trial, and so you had all the witnesses testify and be cross-examined. You know, a huge amount of evidence came into it. And as Judge Benitez noted in his opinion, the record of the trial, of all the exhibits and the testimony and everything, was 14,000 pages long. So it's the biggest record that's ever been put together for a judge to be able to decide a case like this. And likewise, Judge Benitez's opinion is the most thorough opinion by far on this topic, in terms of how deeply carefully it examines all the pro-con evidence on all sides.
Well, it's interesting because this is, like you said, these things normally don't go to a full trial. But this has been something that was more or less addressed in Heller and McDonald. And I'm trying to remember which one it was where it was specifically noted that that weapons that are commonly held, and the AR-15 is clearly one of those weapons. There's several million of them that are owned legally by Americans.
Right.
Rifle
in American history.
Right, exactly. That's fully covered by the Second Amendment. And I guess my question is, why did it take a full trial to address that issue? When that it would appear, at least, that the Supreme Court had more or less settled that issue, at least in principle, 10, 12 years ago.
Well, yes, that's a you're right to ask that question. The Supreme Court in Heller was faced with the District of Columbia's ban on handguns, and the reasoning of the majority opinion said essentially after it went through the language of the Second Amendment and, you know, what does it mean? Is it for the militia only? That kind of thing. And it said, you can't ban guns that are in common use and the kind that are typically used by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes. And the court also said, look, handguns are the most commonly chosen arm for self-defense. And it talked about some of the reasons why people might choose a handgun. But the court said, whatever the reason, they are a leading arm that people choose for self-defense, lawful self-defense, and that's it. You can't ban it. Now, the court didn't say that you couldn't have any regulations or restrictions, but outright prohibition was just off the table, says the Supreme Court majority. Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion got very much into the pro-con social science evidence of, you know, here's the evidence, and my brief got cited in there a number of times as part of that pro-con of, oh, here's the evidence about how often handguns are used for defense, here's the evidence about how often handguns are used to commit crimes, here's the pro-con data on handgun accidents, all those kinds of things. And he was very interested in that and conducted what's called an interest balancing test.
Right.
Which is, you have the judges look at the evidence on both sides and weigh the different interests and then come to their own wise decision about what to do. The Heller majority expressly rejected that and said no. The interest balancing was done when people wrote the Second Amendment, and it's not up to the courts to redo the interest balancing based on their own personal views of social policy. So, yes, it should be a very easy case. And, in fact, when a similar ban from a Chicago suburb, there was a cert petition filed in that, Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Scalia, who wrote the Heller opinion, so you'd think he's got a pretty good idea of what it means,
right,
wrote a dissent from the court's denial of certiorari, the court's decision not to take the case, and said exactly that. As we already told you, we showed you how to do this in Heller. It's very easy to do. All you got to find out if they're common and typically used by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes, which is obviously true, and that should be the end of the case. But in the Ninth Circuit, like in lots of other lower courts, the courts, rather than following what Heller and the McDonald case on the Chicago handgun ban a couple years later shows you is how to do these cases. Instead, the courts use a different test they invented, which is basically Justice Breyer's test of, oh, let's look up all the social science evidence, pro and con, and with a big thumb on the scale in favor of making lots of presumptions in favor of the government, you uphold the law. And that's the approach that the Ninth Circuit has been using on gun cases. And so that's what Judge Benitez, who is a district court trial judge within the Ninth Circuit, had to do. You know, if you're a district judge, you do what your circuit court of appeals tells you.
Right.
And so he conducted a very in-depth analysis of the pro-con evidence on the issue.
So that's what this trial was about. It was basically about Justice Breyer's balancing test. He basically followed that playbook, because that is, again, like you said, the Ninth Circuit's precedent in dealing with these things. And the balancing test, in his opinion, which you can read, it's 94 pages, showed that the weapons that were being precluded by the state of California were commonly held, commonly used weapons that weren't, and I'm going to go ahead and quote here, these are not about extraordinary weapons lying at the outer limits of Second Amendment protection. The banned, quote, assault weapons, end quote, are not bazookas, howitzers, or machine guns, which would be very unusual for normal citizens to own and are precluded in almost every instance from private ownership.
Or at least it's certainly not part of your Second Amendment right. And if you want to own a howitzer, you plan on spending a lot of time in and regulation on getting it. But yeah, you can't walk into a gun store and walk out with a howitzer after you pass the background check.
Well, and I think, and again, we're speaking with Dave Koppel, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I think it's important to remember, too, that in the context of extraordinary weapons lying at the outer limits of Second Amendment protection, such as bazookas, howitzers, and machine guns, there are federal restrictions on that are all that already basically preclude any state regulation against them, because the federal government all but precludes that. And machine guns are a great example of this. I believe it was 1984 that the federal government finally barred private ownership of machine guns, except for very, very certain situations. And the licensing on this is extraordinary. It takes a long time to be able to make the case that you need a fully automatic weapon. And while those do exist, those licenses do exist, they're very, very difficult to come by. So the states don't even need to do anything about that. These, though, are ways that this law in California that was passed in 1989 was a way to get around the federal government's decision not to restrict weapons, semi-automatic weapons. The AR-15 is a semi-automatic weapon, which means you pull the trigger once, only one bullet comes out. Same thing was true with pistols of either revolvers or magazine-loaded pistols. You pull the trigger once, you get one bullet that comes out, semi-automatic. That's the area that we're now in. And in 1989, you didn't have Heller, you didn't have McDonald, and there was room for the state to have that sort of discussion. Now, though, that room has been pretty much basically eliminated by, especially by McDonald, which incorporated the Second Amendment for as an individual right.
Yes, so McDonald says, McDonald versus City of Chicago was the 2010 case that says the Second Amendment applies via the 14th Amendment, is enforceable against state and local governments, just like most of the rest of the Bill of Rights is. The federal government's got to obey the First Amendment, so do state and local governments, and likewise state and local governments have to obey the Second Amendment, just like they have to obey the First.
Exactly. And again, it's an incorporation doctrine. It's at least now, in terms of McDonald, it's at least a decade old. I think it's 12 years old. Is McDonald from
2010?
2010. So it's 11 years old.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and this keeps coming up, though. I mean, one can understand why a 1989 law would need to be reviewed and need to be challenged in order to get it appealed. But you're talking about the Ninth Circuit again, and the Ninth Circuit has another case that did just take place. The Ninth Circuit itself actually ruled on this en banc, Young versus Hawaii, which came to the not just the opposite conclusion of McDonald, but Heller and a whole lot of other things when they ruled that Hawaiian tradition can override the Second Amendment to some extent. It was a very odd decision. And the reason why I bring up Young versus Hawaii is I think the Supreme Court's going to be looking at that pretty soon. But also because it sort of sets up the environment in which this case that Judge Benitez concluded, which is, I'm trying to remember the name of the case. It's, Miller versus Bonta, Miller v. Bonta. That's the environment that it's going to be reviewed in at the Ninth Circuit. So tell us a little bit about what Benitez's ruling can expect from a circuit, from an appellate circuit that just delivered this ruling in Young v. Hawaii. Maybe you might want to get into that one a little bit as well.
Sure. Well, the Ninth Circuit had previously, in a case called Peruta, said there's no right to concealed carry under the Second Amendment. And so then this Young versus Hawaii case challenges Hawaii's total ban on carrying in general. You can't carry at all in Hawaii without a license, for which you'll never get a license unless you're a professional security guard on the job. And so in Hawaii, you can't carry concealed and you can't carry openly. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Young versus Hawaii this spring said that actually when the Constitution says there's the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, that actually doesn't protect any right to carry guns at all in any manner. There is no right to carry a firearm, you know, maybe on your own property, but, you know, not anywhere, you know, outside your home or property. And it's a completely implausible opinion in terms of legal history. And a lot of what it accomplishes, it does only by a lot of pretty aggressive quote chopping to try to make cases stand for the opposite of what they say. But what this showed, and that they reversed a 2-1 decision by a 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit that said, yeah, no, we're going to, the plaintiff's claim should not have been dismissed by the lower court. They've raised a real issue, and now we're going to send it back to the trial court for more analysis. Then the Ninth Circuit as a whole voted to take the case en banc. En banc means on the bench. It means you get all or almost all of the circuit court judges in the area to get together and hear the case as a large group. So, for example, in the Tenth Circuit, the cases would be normally heard by three randomly selected three-judge panels, but at the court of an en banc, you might have all 14 judges of the Tenth Circuit hear the case. You know, en banc cases happen rarely, and they're only for cases of exceptional importance. The policy in the Ninth Circuit is whenever any three-judge panel rules in favor of the Second Amendment, the other judges on the circuit take the case en banc and overturn it. No Second Amendment victory ever survives in the Ninth Circuit. If it's you take it as far as the three-judge panel and you win, the Ninth Circuit en banc will reverse it. They are as hostile to the Second Amendment as you could possibly be. No Second Amendment case has ever won in the Ninth Circuit when the losing side decided they wanted to push it all the way up to an en banc.
And again, we're speaking with David Koppel. You can find out more about David at davekoppel.org, K-O-P-E-L. He's on Twitter at Dave Koppel. So my point in bringing this up is, first off, you can pretty much expect that Judge Benitez's ruling here in Miller v. Bonta is probably not going to survive review in the Ninth Circuit, but it will probably end up getting kicked up to the Supreme Court nonetheless, unless the Supreme Court acts in such a manner where the precedent is so obvious that the Supreme Court has no other choice but to uphold Benitez in this case. Did Benitez... Let me ask you this. I mean, I'm curious because it's very colorful, some colorful writing in this opinion, which is a little unusual in and of itself. You see some colorful writing in judicial opinions, but usually they're a little on the dry side. But I did have to laugh when I was reading this, and it's like the Swiss Army knife, the popular AR-15 rifle is a perfect combination of home defense weapon and homeland defense equipment. I don't have a problem with the AR-15. I'm not sure that the Swiss Army knife is a perfect combination of home defense weapon. At least not the Swiss Army knives that I've ever seen. It's a great bottle opener and can opener. But he's gotten some heat for some of the colorful things that he writes in this. Do you think he did that as in order to be provocative enough to make sure that this you know caused a bit of a sensation with the other jurists in the Ninth Circuit?
I think what he was doing was refuting a lot of really bad and inaccurate descriptions of the AR-15, and similar guns that have been existed in other opinions. There was one judge in another court who said using an AR-15, you know, using a so-called assault weapon, and that's a very made-up term that doesn't describe any actual... Yeah. Real category of guns, but he said using one of these for self-defense, that would be like smashing a walnut with a sledgehammer, and which is ridiculous.
Right.
And you know that these guns are actually too powerful for self-defense, and supposedly they fire super fast, which is completely not true. They fire at the same rate as any common handgun, you know, a semi-automatic pistol from Glock or Smith & Wesson or Ruger, the other common companies, they don't fire one bit faster than the average handgun most people own these days.
Right.
So he's explaining that, no, these are actually really the reason the AR is the most popular rifle in American history is because it is so good at the utility for multiple purposes. It's actually by the size of the bullet it fires, 223, meaning 200, the bullet's width is 223 thousandths of an inch, so it's smaller than a quarter inch wide. It is low powered enough with low recoil so that it works well for home defense, and especially by people who don't have a lot of upper body strength to handle, you know, say some big shotgun with a lot of recoil.
Right.
And it's not really powerful enough for serious big game hunting, but it's powerful enough to go, say, deer hunting with, and lots of people go deer hunting with it. It's a very accurate rifle, so it's great for target shooting, and of course accuracy is also really important for self-defense. So him talking about the multiple utilities of that gun, I think, is really appropriate, especially when opinions from other courts have disparaged these guns and their owners and basically said, you know, nobody's actually got anything they can really do with this gun. They're not useful for anything. And to the contrary, they're highly useful, which is why they end up getting bought in such large numbers.
And just to sort of complete the loop, we've got about a minute left. One of the big issues with this focus on so-called assault weapons, not just the fact that that's sort of a nonsense term, but it's because the number of homicides committed with long-barreled firearms of any type is a very small, very, very surpassing small percentage of all homicides that occur with firearms in the United States, something around 6%. Most of them are committed by handguns. And that includes justifiable homicides as well when people use them for protection. So, I mean, the whole obsession with the AR-15 just sort of defies common sense.
Well, you can go back to when this issue was invented by the gun ban lobby, which is the 1980s. Josh Sugarman was a strategist for an anti-gun group, now has his own group called the Violence Policy Center. And he wrote a memo, which was very, and it's not, this isn't any, some kind of secret thing. He
Right.
put the memo up on his website. Anybody can read it. He said, look, guys, you know, fellow handgun ban lobbyists, the public and the press have gotten bored with the handgun issue. We're not getting anywhere on it. So what can, you know, let's try and do something new and different and interesting. And he said, let's do assault weapons.
Professor Koppel, we're going to have to leave it at that, Professor Koppel. DaveKoppel.org is where you can find him. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Get informed and get connected. It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Be sure to stay tuned after the top of the hour to the Cale Clark Show, where they will be discussing the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Cale Clark coming on at 5 p.m. Central Time. Be sure to hang on for that. Right now, however, we're going to talk a little bit about embryonic research and the removal of a time limit on when that research must stop. This is a really disturbing development, and here to discuss it is Father Tad Poholjik. He's the director of education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He's the author of a column called Making Sense Out of Bioethics that appears in various diocesan newspapers around the country. You can find out more about that at fathertad.com. Father, great to have you back with us.
Great to be with you, Ed. Thank you.
Well, this is actually something that's flown a little under my radar screen until just recently, this decision to expand the window for embryonic research. Tell us a little bit, first off, what it is exactly that we're talking about here.
Well, so this is a kind of consensus that scientists came up with actually a long time ago, many decades ago. I believe it was in the 1970s. And basically what it says is that if you're going to be doing some experiments on humans who are embryos, you should only allow that experiment to go a maximum of 14 days or 2 weeks. And after that point, you should make sure that you destroy those embryos. Don't allow them to grow any longer than that. And part of the reasoning, the way this was originally framed as a kind of justification, was they said, well, around 2 weeks of development, that's when you start to see some initial indicators of the rudiments of a nervous system. So that's, you know, the very beginning of the brain primordium, as they call it, that early starting point. And they were saying, well, so maybe that seems like it's a little more important, and therefore we don't want to keep experimenting on these embryos at these early ages if they're starting to develop nervous tissue. So, you know, this was touted, I would say, rather widely as, look, you know, here's an important ethical line. And we as scientists are being fastidious about observing this line, etc. Now, the interesting thing is that for all those years that this rule was in place, it wasn't even possible to grow a human embryo beyond about maybe 10 days. So, right. You know, the rule was there, but it was basically arbitrary and didn't affect any researchers' experiments at all until we hit 2016. And that's when everything changed, because there was a researcher who figured out how to grow human embryos beyond 2 weeks. So as you can imagine, that's when the chorus of voices arose that said, oh, we've got to get rid of the 2-week, 14-day rule for embryos. We need to be able to do our research. We have some important discoveries that we could make, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there was no longer this kind of paying attention or giving lip service anyway to the ethics through this rule. It suddenly became now a disposable marker, if you will, in the world of research on embryos.
And Father Ted, I mean, let's just underscore the fact that, you know, the Catholic Church opposes this type of embryonic research regardless, right? I mean, this is not, the 14-day limit isn't coming from us.
That's absolutely correct.
We think this is a bad idea in terms of bioethics right from the get-go. This is not something that we shouldn't be creating embryos in life just to experiment on it and then later destroy it.
And we shouldn't be creating embryos outside the marital embrace at all.
Right.
That's what the Church definitively teaches, that any time you do that, you are immediately engaging in a serious evil. Anytime you create an embryo in glassware, in a laboratory somewhere, by mixing somebody's sperm and egg together, you are violating the dignity of that little human who you have just brought into the world by treating him as something manipulable, now able to be frozen, now able to be handed on to other researchers for stem cell extraction, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this all flows out of our decision back in 1978 to go down the runway of in vitro fertilization. And the Church warned, you know, the world that if you do this, there will be consequences. And we're seeing all those consequences now as we try to march bravely, you know, with a straight face into the brave new world around us. And so these embryonic experimentation questions, you know, reveal how much we're willing to depersonalize our own children. These are our children who we're doing experiments on. And,
right.
You know, nobody wants to kind of state that baldly in the research world, but that's at the heart of what we're doing.
And it's interesting, too. I mean, one of the issues that comes up with this, and again, we're speaking with Father Tad Pahulchik and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. If you've got any questions or comments about this, 888-914-9149, is that, you know, the time limit that was established on this was very convenient to the extent of scientific capability at the time. And I'm going to read something from Technology Review. This is from March, when this was first being discussed, is that, you know, they want to extend the time on this, but now they don't necessarily want to give a hard limit. And I'm just going to read this really quickly. It says the ISSCR is not going to set a specific new time limit, like 28 or 36 days, according to one person familiar with the rule change. While hard limits may be reassuring, they are likely to be overtaken by science again, which is why the society wants to move to a more flexible approach. And basically what they're saying here is that they don't really want any limits, and they never really did want any limits. They want to be able to experiment on embryos, fetuses, all of these being human beings, for as long as they scientifically can make it a reality. There's the idea of a limit here is... or I should say an artificial limit here, is and has always been nonsense.
Yeah, I agree. And that's it points out the arbitrary character of designating any number like that. So this is basically for the purposes of show and appearances, to be able to talk ethics without actually doing any real ethics. You know, it's a very... clever stratagem that has been employed and has worked for a long time. You know, I often, sometimes people will say, well, I mean, the 14-day rule, it seems like that was based on something, at least. It was based on the fact that there was no nervous system yet. But I always will come back to that kind of claim and say, look, the important thing is not whether you have a nervous system. The important thing is whether you are the kind of creature that can make a human nervous system. And if you can do that, you're already infinitely valuable. You're already a member of the species. You're already a brother and sister to us, and you should not be experimented upon at all. And so, you know, I think the issue here is they're looking for sort of markers along the continuum. But the problem is it is a continuum, and you and I originated as embryos, and in fact, every single person on the face of the planet was once an embryo.
Right.
So it's very easy to lose touch with our own humble origins, and scientists have become very sophisticated at carrying out that kind of mental disconnect. And, you know, once you do that, once you cordon off a portion of humanity and declare it to be different enough from you and me, that's, of course, what we did in slavery. You create a subclass, and once you have a subclass, you have the grounds to go forward with some very, very grave evils.
Well, indeed. And the same article from Technology Review from March almost gives you an idea of what's coming, and not necessarily in a disapproving manner. It says others believe the long-term growth of normal, and I should preface this by saying that they're talking about opposition to this, Father Tad Pahulchik, first off, but they say others believe that the long-term growth of normal embryos or embryo models would create a platform to explore the genetic engineering of humans. More fully developed embryos could be used to study the consequences of gene editing and other types of modification. That is, if genetically modified humans are to be created in the future, the modification should first be tested for safety on lab embryos. We would have to ensure that they develop normally, and to do that, you have to study them beyond 14 days, says Inso Hyun, a bioethicist at Case Western Reserve University, who has argued in favor of easing the rule. You need to study that embryo as long as you can. Father Tad, they're not even really hiding this very well anymore, are they?
Right. I think you've got it right, Ed. This has reached the point that they realize there's been enough kind of passivity around the issue, and nobody has stood up and defended young humans who are embryos, except for the Catholic Church. And So they're reading the cultural winds and saying, you know, as long as we promise some great benefits here. And I mean, for example, they'll say things like, well, if we can experiment on early embryos, we can help reduce the rate of miscarriages. And people say, oh, well, that's a good thing. We don't want too many miscarriages. So therefore, why don't you just go ahead and, you know, continue your experiments? And people don't really, you know, look at the actual material that they are proposing to push forward with, you know, the actual proposals to experiment on young humans who are still embryos. So I think we're in a cultural moment where, first of all, science is kind of complicated, and a lot of people feel like, you know, it's beyond my pay grade to follow all this, and people have become passive, and we are in a pro-abortion culture where life already is expendable on multiple levels. So the embryo thing becomes like just another instance of what is already pretty much universally accepted. And that's how I think these scientists, you know, are reading the tea leaves and willing to now do something that only 20, 30 years ago, they would never in their wildest dreams have dared to suggest. They would have been, you know, laughed out of the room. But this is what we refer to as the slippery slope. You kind of keep saying things little by little and, you know, turning up the temperature, as they say. And before you know it, people are not aware anymore of the gravity of the very moral evils that they are dealing with.
So how many humans are consumed in this research a year? Does anybody have any real knowledge of this? How many of these embryos are created and destroyed in a typical year of all this research going on?
Well, those numbers are not available as far as I know.
Right.
Because partly what is done is they, in many instances, these experiments will not involve putting sperm and egg together just for the researcher. Instead, what they will do is the researcher will set up an arrangement with the fertility clinic. And so they will ask mom and dad, they will ask parents to sign a consent form so that their embryos can be handed over to these researchers and experimented on. And many parents, regrettably, will sign those consent forms. And that's the source of most of the embryos that are used in research. There probably is a certain number, but it's a small number, I suspect, that are produced fresh in those laboratories by joining sperm and egg. But that tends to be done instead in the clinic as part of the in vitro fertilization process. And then the leftover, quote unquote, leftover embryos are the ones that will later be surrendered to the researchers.
It's interesting. There's a piece at MercatorNet.com that talks about this, and I believe this is from a little bit more. This is just from, I believe, last weekend or last week. And they note that nobody's really got good, hard, and fast numbers now, but there was apparently a report in 2007 in the UK about how many were, destroyed during that one particular year or 2 years, 2006 and 2007, and it was around just under 9,000 apparently. And I mean that's an awful lot of human beings that were destroyed in this process. That's just maybe 2 years.
Yes, and that's just for Great Britain, presumably.
Yes.
So, you know, United States numbers would conceivably be larger. And I think the other piece here is that there has been some data on how many human embryos are stored in the deep freeze in these liquid nitrogen canisters, you know, extremely cold temperatures where they keep them frozen. And it's in excess in the United States of 1 million embryos. The last estimate I heard was maybe 1.2, 1.3 million. And that number is going up by probably tens of thousands of embryos each day. In other words, these fertility clinics are, mass production efforts that are going on in every major city in the U.S. right under our noses, and really nobody is hardly even aware of it. And we're trapping vast numbers of humans in this way. So, there are very significant injustices, core injustices, that we have learned to sort of not look at as a society. And the scientists, I think, are aware of that and are able to utilize then human beings as a kind of raw material for their research projects. And, it's just important, I think, and it's great that you're doing a show on this topic, for us to raise awareness and consciousness of the gravity of these problems. The church has been trying for decades, and we need to continue to be formed very, very carefully around this issue, because these, as I mentioned earlier, they're our own progeny.
Indeed. We're talking with Father Ted Poholcek. We're going to take your calls after the break. We're going to continue this conversation. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
News and commentary from a Catholic lens.
Hear me now.
Catholic lens. I can see clearly now. This is the Drew Mariani Show on the Relevant Radio app.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Coming up on the Cale Clark Show, Jim Burnham is actually sitting in for Cale today, and he will give the biblical case for the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. That's at 5 Central Time, so be sure to stay tuned after the end of this show, because it's going to be a great show from Jim Burnham on the Cale Clark Show. We are speaking with Father Ted Poholcek. You can find out more about everything that we're talking about on Father Ted's website, fatherted.com. And he's got he's the author of a column called Making Sense Out of Bioethics that appears in various diocesan newspapers around the country. He's the director of education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and we're talking about the expansion of the time frame in which embryos can be experimented upon. And of course, we've already talked about this a bit. The Catholic Church opposes all of this experimentation, regardless of whatever the time frames are. But I think that this expansion is extremely worrisome, because I think that this is, and I think it's fairly well established at this point in time, that there are no real functional limits here, except for what scientists can do. And this is, Father Ted, I mean, this has always been an issue with science. I know I'm not an anti-science kind of guy. I'm a very pro-science kind of guy. But there's a difference between what you can do and what you should do. And that's where bioethics come in. And it's the conscience break on what it is that you can do. And I think we're losing that sense of moral context when we're delving into these issues. And I think especially because it's so closely tied, anything that has to do with embryos is so closely tied with the cultural impulse for abortion, that those bioethical breaks just simply are never applied.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. And I agree, Ed. I think we're in a kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, to the extent that we have enough members of society who are actively seeking to promote and even to fund with our own taxpayer money the direct destruction of our own children in utero. Once that becomes something that's culturally tolerated, that kind of evil that's tolerated, then, you say to yourself, well, gee, those types of events, those later abortions, clearly involve humans who look much more like you and me, who have, you know, hands and feet and a face, versus an embryo, which is completely unfamiliar to us. It looks like a ball of cells very early on, with very few, you know, things that would distinguish it as being human to the naked eye. So it's very easy to rationalize that that is something we don't have to exercise great care over. But the reality is that we do, that these are still our children, these are still our offspring, and we have very serious duties here. You know, and I sometimes use an example for people to try to reconnect the conscience piece that you were referring to. And this is when I deal, for example, with couples who have in the freezer maybe 7 or 8 children. They did IVF, let's say, you know, 10 years ago.
Right.
They weren't practicing their faith at that time. Then they discovered that the church does not support doing in vitro fertilization. And they realized, oh my, what did we do? We now have 10 kids frozen, and we're past childbearing age ourselves. What should we do? And they will come, you know, to us at the National Catholic Bioethics Center with this dilemma. And one of the things that I'll say to them is, these are your children, it's true. And you should understand that when you have children, you have duties towards them. And since you cannot carry out the typical list of duties that we have towards our kids, like educating them, feeding them, putting a roof over their head, buying clothes for them, you can't do any of that for your embryonic children. The only thing you really can do is continue to pay the bill to the company that is pouring fresh liquid nitrogen into their canisters to keep them frozen. That shows your love and concern for your children who are in these frozen orphanages, as it were. Right. And people understand that. They say, yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay, yeah, I'm going to continue to pay the bill here. And, you know, I may even set up a small trust fund after I die just to cover for a few more years for my kids as a sign of my regret about what I've done. So people, you know, the conscience is still there. But I think we sometimes have to walk people now a little more explicitly along the path to see the line between right and wrong. And I think we're in that same position with researchers in laboratories. They have desensitized themselves. And I think the general public, you know, has a calling here to raise the bar ethically.
Do you get a lot of requests for advice from the researchers that are in these industries? Do you hear from them? Well, in either direction, do you hear from them in terms of wanting to comply with the teachings of the church and teachings of Christ? Do you get a lot of pushback from some of these people that you're criticizing? What type of feedback do you deal with there?
Yes, so I would say both directions. We certainly do get researchers who come to us, and for example, they might be, a researcher working in a big pharmaceutical company or at a big university, and they realize, gee, you know, I'm in a collaboration with a nearby lab, and they're starting to do things that are raising concerns. Can I continue our collaboration? We're very far along the path of sharing data, et cetera. So, you know, we will help them understand some of the limits of cooperation and evil. And, you know, in the other direction, sometimes, for example, I will travel and speak on in vitro fertilization. And I remember one time, I think it was in Texas, I was giving a talk, and in the audience there was a fellow who ran an IVF clinic and did IVF himself. And yes, he tried to push back. He tried to, you know, justify what he was doing and argued, you know, with me during that presentation a little bit about, you know, well, this is a good thing, isn't it? We're trying to help couples to have a baby, and we all like babies, don't we? And isn't this, you know, pro-life to be doing this? So, you know, we had a very important discussion, and I hope it was helpful to him. But yes, we certainly deal with both sides of the issue. People who are wanting to step away from situations that involve them in cooperation in these kinds of evils and others who are still perhaps struggling to understand more completely the gravity of the concerns.
We are speaking with Father Tad Poholcek, and again, fathertad.com is his website. And the reason why I bring this up is, you know, obviously we're dealing with some very grave issues here when you're talking about expanding experimentation on human embryos. I mean, really, the 9 months is the limit here. I mean, it really sounds like they want to continue to do this all the way through to gestation, and especially in terms of gene editing and genetic manipulation, from that one piece from the technology review that I'd read earlier. The more that gets public, I think, the more people are going to come to you with those types of regrets. And I know we've only got about 30 seconds left. I'm going to go ahead and let you wrap up, Father Tad.
Yeah, I agree. You're pointing to the next horizon, which is gene modification of humans. And that really is what we need to be keeping our eye on, because we have gone so far down the slippery slope that now we're going to try to produce designer babies and control all kinds of aspects of our offspring, treating them like products that we can dial in their features.
And I think it's all about, again, making the fatal assumption that we are God and that God isn't. And Father Tad Poholcek, make sure you go to fathertad.com to find out more about these bioethical issues, these grave bioethical issues. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. God bless you. Have a great evening.